everyone. Welcome to today's show. My name is Spencer Walsh. Thank you so much for joining us here today on the show. We got a good one for you, as always. Here is a look into what are we talking about today. The U.S. economy, we are taking a look at the GDP report. It is out for the third quarter. Gross domestic product has increased by 0.6% after two quarters of decline, but key components are continuing to show an economic slowdown. We'll take a look at what that means for you as the Fed-induced recession continues apace here in this country. Meanwhile, speaking of the Fed has always been, and you know, institutionalists in Washington, D.C. and in this country are always telling you a bunch of, frankly, crap. Like, oh, the Fed is an, you know, independent institution. Yeah, well, it's independent in the same way the Supreme Court is independent, and look what they just did. You know, they fell victim to a decades-long right-wing lobbying project to overturn one of American women's fundamental, most basic rights. Well, the Fed, it's kind of like that as well. They are being lobbied now by some of the biggest banks. Daniel Bogislaw and Ken Klippenstein are on that story in The Intercept. Also in The Intercept, Mike Mullen, the former head of the Joint Chiefs, former President Barack Obama, you may have heard of him, and the Congressional Progressive Caucus, they all are saying one thing that the media doesn't want you to hear. We'll tell you what that is, and also the calamity around the corner if the Republicans go the midterms way, or the midterms go the Republicans' way, excuse me. No, I'm not talking about the end of democracy, you know, or something like that. I'm talking about something much more acute and something much more, frankly, realistic. But let's get into it. You know, honestly, both of the things that I'm going to talk about, you know, democracy and the thing I'm going to talk about may just very likely happen. But, you know, it's possible both ways. Either way, things could go very, very badly here. And that's why you should listen to Newsflash to keep abreast of all of it. But we are getting right into it here today, starting at the top with the economy. This piece here in the New York Times. The U.S. economy grew slowly over the summer, adding to fears of a looming recession, but also keeping alive the hope that one might be avoided. Gross domestic product, adjusted for inflation, returned to growth in the third quarter after two consecutive quarterly contractions, according to government data released on Thursday. But consumer spending slowed as inflation ate away at households' buying power, and the sharp rise in interest rates led to the steepest contraction in the housing sector in the first months of the pandemic. You know, we're going to see, you know, continued raise of interest rates. We're going to see that, I think, is going to be the biggest thing that, you know, you're going to see a lot of effort to tell you that, no, it's inflation. Inflation is the big problem here that we are seeing. It is the, you know, the thing that everyone is always, you know, is worried about. It's affecting households here. But what is going to really, you know, because the real drivers of the economy are, in big coordinated ways, they are really the number one. The people at the top are these big corporations, the people at the commanding heights of American kind of capitalism. Those people are going to be making decisions based on, you know, what they can get, what they feel they can get for their return on their investment. And if they don't feel like they're going to get a return on their investment, well, then they are not going to, you know, they're not going to make these, you know, long-term, they're going to start to make some cuts, is essentially what's going to have to happen. And for the cuts that they're going to be able to make first, and it's going to make sense for the market that they make these cuts first, is going to be your job. It's going to be your source of employment. And that is going to be something that, you know, frankly, Jerome Powell and the people in charge of the economy who have been, as we're going to talk about, you know, they're very independent. They just want what's best. They are making these decisions. And again, the people like in the New York Times, they'd like to have you believe that, oh, they're just doing it in the best interest of the economy. They're trying to, you know, balance inflation and unemployment. They're just doing their absolute level best. But this is a conscious decision because the labor market is getting too tight. We've been saying it for a long time. Workers are having, you know, too much buying power. And there's also a really just runaway epidemic in, you know, key sectors and key industries such as oil, you know, energy, all across the world. Inflation soaring, food prices taking advantage of just, you know, unrestricted access, or, you know, unrestricted ability to, you know, raise prices because, you know, everyone's already saying there's inflation. Why not, you know, raise the prices? Corporate profiteering, this, you know, price gouging effect of we can increase our profit margins. We're seeing it, you know, the price of oil, you know, is around the same as it was in, you know, 2013, 2014, the last time we did a big oil price spike, right? But gas, you know, comparatively, the price of gas at the pump is way, way more because the in the world that we live in, these big companies have felt the pressure to always be increasing these profit margins. They're running out of places to do it, and they're just finally, you know, they're turning to prices. We are now, especially in the West, we're seeing, you know, less and less access to cheap, convenient consumer goods. That's going to be a huge, huge deal. So the report underscores the delicate balance facing the Federal Reserve. Again, yeah, it's a delicate balance that got so much to work with here. You know, it's like all these things are, you know, what the New York Times here is going to, you know, try to portray it as is very, very important that you understand that the Federal Reserve here is dealing with a lot. They're all just throwing this stuff is being thrown at them. All this Jerome Powell sitting there every day just blasted with the economy that is not at all of his own making. Well, you can see these policies and you can see how these policies are being made and the effect that they're having on people. Well, he is pulling these levers literally to great effect. So the third quarter data, GDP rose 0.6%. The Commerce Department said that 2.6% annual rate of growth suggested that a path to such a soft landing remained open but narrow. 2.6% annual rate of growth is, you know, what we kind of need in terms of inflation and interest rate cooling off. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, how much pressure that is needed, because, you know, Jerome Powell seems all too happy to get in there. You know, it is, yeah, really, you know, very, 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 you know, very, very, very likely that I think based on what I've been seeing, what, you know, the Federal Reserve has been kind of signaling, it has been very, very clear that there's not going to be any kind of opportunity for any kind of room for error on that. It's not good that the economy, it's good the economy is not collapsing, said Carol Friedman, an economist at Northwestern. To the extent that we can manage growth that's below trend, but not a complete collapse in consumption and investment, that would be the ideal scenario. And again, this collapse in consumption is only going to be really driven by the Fed. It's not going to be driven by, you know, really any other major factors. It's not like the government's going to be involved. And, you know, really the only – it's going to be Federal Reserve and how the corporations and the markets respond to what the Federal Reserve does to manipulate the markets. You know, political and democratic solutions have pretty much just been, frankly, taken out of the equation here. Yeah, so, again, this really is the crux of it. Policymakers have aggressively raised interest rates in recent months and are expected to do so again at their next meeting next week in an effort to cool off red-hot demand, which they believe has contributed to the rapid increase in prices. But they're trying to do so without snuffing out the recovery entirely. And again, they're just, you know, doing it just the right moment that demand and, you know, just the general, you know, average, you know, group of working class people are not going to be totally, totally unproductive as economic engines. But the point is, they're just going to be a lot more easy to control and to manage. That is really, you know, the goal. So, for months, doomsayers have been arguing the U.S. economy is in recession, and congressional Republicans have been rooting for a downturn, he said. But today, we got further evidence that our economic recovery is continuing to power forward. By one common definition, the U.S. economy entered a recession when it started experiencing two quarters of shrinking GDP. The start of the year, officially, recessions are determined by a group of researchers at the National Bureau of Economic Research who look at a broad array of indicators, including employment, income, and spending. Most analysts don't believe the economy meets the formal definition, and the third quarter numbers, which slightly exceeded forecasters' expectations, provided further evidence that a recession has not yet begun. But the overall GDP figures are skewed by the international trade component, which often exhibits big swings from one period to the next. Economists tend to focus on less volatile components, which have showed the recovery steadily losing momentum as the year has progressed. As again, interest rates have risen and inflation has continued apace. Because, this is not this interest rate stuff. It targets, you know, much more consumer purchases at the middle and kind of, middle income levels, and you know that is going to be a very, very, you know, Volcker shock style situation, very, very fast. And we're already seeing that. And you know, maybe if they go really, really high and break the ceiling, you know, really just push those interest rates up, it may do something. But you know, we've seen rates being raised for, you know, almost more than a year now, I want to say, and it does not seem to be easing the tide of inflation, which, you know, I think will be largely eased when a certain labor conditions in the markets there get reached first. That's definitely the more important thing. Let's go now to a little bit more about the people who are going to be making these decisions that, you know, I love so much when I hear people say, oh, it's, you know, you gotta respect the independence of the group. You got, like, these are smart people, these are talented people, and we need to just make sure that they are the, you know, the absolute best people who are, you know, we need to look after them, you know, their independence that keep our democracy functioning. And obviously a lot of people say that, you know, two main bodies, Supreme Court and Federal Reserve. So Federal Reserve runs the economy, and the Supreme Court pretty much runs everything else. And they have really, really immense unelected undemocratic power. You know, it's under intense pressure, the Federal Reserve is. This is no new reporting here in The Intercept, at all times, from massive commercial banks and other financial institutions advocating for favorable regulations, according to federal lobbying disclosures reviewed by The Intercept, as well as interviews with former Fed and other finance employees. The Federal Reserve has come under scrutiny in recent months for its aggressive rate hikes designed to, as Jerome Powell said, get wages down and then get inflation down. Because, again, high wages, you know, I don't know if you've seen the data, guys. Wages are just spiking. You know, they're going, real wages in real terms, they're going so high right now, it's out of control. No, it's absolutely ridiculous. So, again, they're targeting something that is, by definition, not going to get inflation down. The Fed's own research has warned that aggressive policy mirrors a similar, that this, its aggressive policy currently mirrors a similar one caused a severe recession under Paul Volcker in the 1980s, which The Intercept recently reported. So even as the United Nations, which recently warned the Fed's rate hikes risked inflicting worse damage than the 2008 financial crisis and the COVID-19 shock in 2020. This is, again, the Fed's doing. So the Federal Reserve here, you have to understand, has a lot of power over your life. By raising these interest rates too high, too fast, they could create a economic shock worse than both 2008 and 2020 under COVID. So, again, yeah, President Biden, unlike Donald Trump, has declined to publicly criticize the Fed, saying after it began hiking rates earlier that he would respect the Fed's independence. It's just so, it really is, you know, embarrassing, frankly, as he, you know, sees his own economy that, you know, he supposedly has control of because, you know, president's most powerful person in the room at all times. Yeah right. But was that, you're just kind of just seeing it slip away from him. Besides setting money, monetary policy, the Fed also is also tasked with regulating commercial banks. Senator Elizabeth Warren opposed Powell's nomination by Trump in 2018 and Biden in 2021 due to what she considered his weak position on banking regulations. Powell will not roll back critical rules to help guard against another financial crisis, and that is a risk we can simply not afford. The intense lobbying the Fed is subjected to is targeted at these banking regulations. To take just one example, Chamber of Commerce, the main business lobby in the United States, is reportedly lobbying on Powell's nomination, along with Federal Reserve regulatory reform, i.e. deregulation. Powell was known to favor as part of his $15.39 million lobbying activities in the first quarter of 2018. The Fed under Powell would go on to water down key elements of the Dodd-Frank regulations passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, so it looks like it was a good investment. So again, these are the people who we've seen. We covered it on Newsflash very, very frequently, where we just see the illustration right in front of us, someone saying, oh, I hope interest rates get raised, it would be pretty awesome, you know, and they just so happen to be a very powerful figure on Wall Street or in the real estate market or something else. Like, they are telling you that they want something to happen. And, you know, every place you look, you see, oh, this is the general trend among literally the most powerful people in our economy. And then what do you know? The interest rates continue to raise and raise and raise. So paid lobbyists make their case on behalf of massive financial corporations, the same fashion K Street lobbyists hawking their wares to members of Congress. In 2022 alone, over 120 groups reported lobbying the Fed on issues ranging from credit card fees to cryptocurrency to sprawling monetary policy initiatives such as mortgage finance. Postings on the Federal Reserve website in the past year recorded meetings with Discover Financial, Student Loan Servicing Alliance, National Bankers Association, Capital One, JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs. And U.S. banks saw their profits rise 7.8% in the second quarter of 2022 because of these rate hikes. So again, these are, again, literally direct benefits because of these rate hikes that the Federal Reserve is seeing. And these are, again, rate hikes that the Federal Reserve itself, keep that in mind, does say that it will literally, cause just as much damage as both the 2008 crisis and the 2020 COVID crisis. So I think, you know, that's certainly something to keep in mind. The Federal Reserve, next time you hear them say, claims, oh, they're so independent, you know, they're just trying to do the right thing for you. I would say that needs a pretty deep fact check.
My name is Spencer Walsh. This is the Spencer Walsh Radio Network. And if you're listening to one of our podcasts, whether it's Newsflash, Hidden History, The Spencer Walsh Show, or something else, ladies and gentlemen, we have one simple request of you. Please be sure to rate us, subscribe to us if you like us, and leave us a comment, because just like all of you, sometimes we need that feedback in our lives, good or bad. We want to hear what you have to say. So please do those steps. Make SWR and content better. And thank you so much for listening.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. So it is now time to get into our next story. This one's actually not in the plan here, but I did want to kind of go back through it real quick because it really is just wonderful. We've talked about this ad on the show before, but it was a very popular ad around the Super Bowl. It just premiered, actually not around the Super Bowl, but kind of recent, or actually a year ago, tomorrow. October 28, 2021, the company Crypto.com premiered an ad starring Matt Damon. After it appeared during the NFL games, it drew a great deal of attention, for Damon suggesting that only cowards would fail to buy cryptocurrency. But if you jumped in with both feet, you would be demonstrating courage comparable to that of astronauts. Crypto.com, based in Singapore, is a platform that mainly allows users to trade in cryptocurrencies. On that day, Bitcoin, the most famous cryptocurrency, was trading at $6,608 a piece. As of the moment this was published, one Bitcoin costs about a third of that, at $20,717. So that means if you're encouraged by Damon to buy $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, it would now be worth $342. So again, would have been pretty brave for you to have done that. We said at the time it was going to turn out in an absolute wreck, an absolute mess, and that literally was the peak, the top of the crypto market, and it literally just plummeted from there into an absolute, just the pits, and has not really come back out since. Yeah, that was the explosion crypto made. Literally right after that ad was published, was pretty interesting. So let's now go to the Interceptor next door here, also by John Schwartz. This was obviously what we talked about on the show last Tuesday. So on Monday, 30 members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, all Democrats, released a memo to President Joe Biden about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In it, they wrote, given the catastrophic possibilities of nuclear escalation and miscalculation, which only increase the longer the war this continues, we agree with your goal of avoiding direct military conflict as an overriding national security priority. Therefore, they urge Biden to make vigorous diplomatic efforts in support of a negotiated settlement and cease fire and engage in direct talks with Russia. So that was met with, as we discussed, some pretty ferocious opposition from other Democrats, including Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. And by Tuesday, Progressive Caucus Chair Representative Pramila Jayapal announced the letter was being formally withdrawn, blaming, quote, staff for the debacle. Just really just the utterly embarrassing moment. Just when you kind of think the Progressive Caucus really just can't get any lower, can't get any more embarrassing, and just frankly useless as a voice of any sort of opposition to the Democratic Party and just the general consensus of Washington, D.C., you kind of get proven wrong again. Even Bernie Sanders, who, you know, really kind of a disappointment in this situation, he was the co-founder of the Progressive Caucus and the only senator who belongs to it. He agreed with the withdrawal. It's really just an absolutely kind of really weak look and position to make, because it just ignores a lot of fundamental realities of the war that, you know, staff or no staff, these people seem to agree, you know, whenever this letter was signed, if, you know, if their story is actually true and it was, you know, published by mistake and some staff member, some evil staff member hit send by accident when no one was looking, which, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, I have no idea, but it's really just, you know, such an embarrassment, especially considering that just over a week ago, former President Barack Obama said some, although not all, of what the Progressive Caucus members wrote in their letter. On October 15th, Obama appeared on the podcast Pod Save America with Tommy Veder, the one of the co-hosts who was also worked on the Obama campaign. Said this to him: "I'm wondering if you have any thoughts for people who are watching this. They're inspired by the Ukrainian resistance. They want them to defend their country successfully, but they're also pretty nervous about continuing escalation, all the chatter about Russia using a nuclear weapon." And he says, "What I think, well, let me be clear. I think what the Ukrainian people accomplish is extraordinary. We do, however, have to be clear. Let me be clear again, folks, and honest with them about what we can do and what we cannot do. And there are lines about we have to determine internally. The U.S., NATO, and others have to take into account the risk of tipping into a U.S.-Russia-NATO conflict as opposed to a Russia-Ukraine conflict." And yeah, that, you know, in my opinion, that's already what it is. But let's see if we can get this.
Speaking of brutal, repressive governments, I mean, it's been 8 months, 9 months since Putin launched this invasion in Ukraine. Right. I think everyone's been impressed with the way the Ukrainians have fought, how effectively they fought. I've been impressed with how much Europe has actually stepped up and supported them. The flip side of that success, though, is the fact that it appears that Russia is losing, or at least losing ground. Putin is getting pushed further into the corner. So I'm just wondering if you have thoughts for people who are watching this. They're inspired by the Ukrainian resistance. They want them to defend their country successfully. Mm-hmm. Right. But they're also pretty nervous about continued escalation and this chatter about, you know, Russia using a nuclear weapon.
I think what the Ukrainian people have accomplished is extraordinary. And it's a testimony to not just the courage of a few soldiers, but this is a entire nation mobilizing in the face of extraordinary odds, and making tremendous sacrifices. And Zelensky himself has risen to the moment in a way that, you know, his biography would not have necessarily anticipated, right? So, at the end of the day, it is not our job to tell the Ukrainians when is it enough, how far should they go, you know, what concessions should they make, et cetera. That's up to them. As their allies, it is important for us to support them financially.
By the way, that this all is stuff that the Progressive Caucus said when they talked about this.
Militarily, through our intelligence. We do have, however, to be clear and honest with them about what we can and cannot do. And there are lines that we have to determine internally, the U.S., NATO, and others, that take into account the risk of this tipping into a Russia-U.S.-NATO conflict as opposed to a Russia-Ukraine conflict. I'm not privy to enough of the intelligence at this stage to, and it's not my job as a private citizen to weigh in on where that line should be drawn. But as we're thinking about, for example, what weapons we're sending in or how we're approaching our support for Ukraine, I think thinking about where defense stops and offense begins and how we manage that is something that we have to pay attention to. And I do think, you know, probably the thing that I'm most concerned about is that lines of communication between the White House and the Kremlin are probably as weak as they have been in a very long time. Yeah. Even in the in some of the lowest points of the Cold War, there was still a sense of the ability to pick up a phone and work through diplomatic channels to send clear signals. And a lot of that is broken down, and I don't think it's the fault of our administration. I think that we're now dealing with a type of Russian regime that is actually even more centralized, even more isolated and closed off. I think Putin has consolidated decision-making to a degree that we haven't seen.
Yeah, so he was talking a little bit there, you know, obviously, about Putin, but it is definitely true that there is no really kind of clear end in sight. Obama obviously didn't urge Biden to work toward a negotiated settlement, but he did express, again, that concern about the conflict spiraling out of control, which I think, you know, it's very, very legit. There's no, you know, he's saying there's no clear kind of way to end this. There's no clear way to, but, you know, ratchet this down. And what he said about the worry, it's interesting to see kind of him talking about worrying about the war becoming a proxy war between the U.S. and NATO and Russia rather than just a Russia-Ukraine war, which, you know, obviously on paper it is, which I would say, and there's been people who have kind of already slipped in this, you know, we've seen kind of more centrist reps on both sides of the aisle just kind of come out straight up and say that, okay, we're essentially trying to remove Putin here. This is really what this whole thing is about. This is why we're in it the way we're in it. And that is a, you know, I really don't think everyone would agree with Obama here that it's so undesirable, which, you know, I personally very much do agree with Obama, but I think it's, you know, other people would not agree that it's not that bad that we get into a proxy war in that part of the world. You know, I don't think it's not something that people, certain people in certain areas of the government would find a lot of offense to at all. So that is a very interesting dynamic. Meanwhile, this is Mike Mullen, a top general, which is very interesting. It'll be interesting to see next time he gets back on TV after saying this. But this is what he had to say about the situation. This is Mike Mullen, former Joint Chief.
So how do you see him saving face? If he doesn't come to the table, if Ukraine can't figure anything out, and you've heard Zelensky as well, yeah, how does he possibly save face, especially after what you said about the bridge?
Well, it's very difficult to see. We've been talking about since before this crisis started an off-ramp for him. I suspect it's in the east, if you will, with those four provinces or some combination of them with respect to how it all ends. And that really is up to, I think, Tony Blinken and other diplomats to figure out a way to get both Zelensky and Putin to the table. And as is typical in any war, it's got to end, and usually there are negotiations associated with that. The sooner the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, somebody who's really actually kind of representing, I think, a very rational opinion, which is like, the, you know, end this thing, the sooner the better, and actually talking about an off-ramp of actually giving up concessions and giving up territory, which is what Pramila Jayapal, you know, scaredly ran out of behind the corner and said, and then just ran right back and covered her face and started crying and apologizing. But she, I think, is definitely right, at least in that area, and that this is, you know, the way it is now, it's going to be, end up being a stalemate in the long term, going to be very hard to resolve. There's going to have to be something that Ukraine gives up in some way, depending on what time the situation is. But, you know, for that to happen, obviously, there has to be the political will for the negotiated settlement. As you can see by the reaction to that letter in the Congressional Progressive Caucus, there will not be any kind of negotiated settlement anytime soon. All right, we'll get to our last story in just 30 seconds. obviously, with the way Biden has been, it's been a little bit frustrating, especially in kind of the early parts of his term. He's done some kind of like last minute things, just last ditch executive actions, throwing him out there. But, you know, there is a interesting consequence of what will happen kind of down the road on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and these entitlement programs, that it's been very rumored that, you know, there would be a default on the debt ceiling, and coming up in 2023, that Republicans will force, and in exchange for, you know, not causing a massive credit crisis, there will, you know, have to be some cuts made to the debt ceiling, which obviously the debt ceiling is something that just shouldn't even really frankly exist in the first place. But he told the crowd of the Democratic National Committee, ain't going to do it, although he literally almost did it in 2012 when he was the vice president. So, you know, we should trust him for that, but we really shouldn't, but it's the best we got. Accompanying that resolve have left a series of related remarks that left fellow Democrats baffled and nervous. The first came from the president when he balked at legislation to simply eliminate the debt limit, which caps how much the government could borrow to meet existing obligations. The second came from Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre after she was asked if the president would not rule out cuts to discretionary spending, and she did not firmly close the door. Again, this is really just like, this also could be factored in Karine Jean-Pierre just not knowing what she's talking about at that given moment, which is, you know, a little bit of a problem. But you know, he literally was about to, what's that? The name of the guy is Harry Reid. His name escaped me for the moment. He really had to like work really, really hard to stop Biden from doing a deal with Mitch McConnell behind his back to stop Social Security. I believe this was in 2014, from cutting Social Security. So Karine Jean-Pierre, she said, I did not have anything to share on policy updates. Pressed for clarity on Jean-Pierre's remarks, spokesperson for the White House, Robin Patterson, replied, we can't respond on every congressional Republican scheme, whether it's raising health care costs, stripping Medicare's ability to bring down prescription drug costs, or cutting seniors off at the knees, but the administration will oppose any effort to play reckless games with our economic catastrophe. But for fellow Democrats, however, this is akin to a family going for a drive, seeing a gorge ahead, and deciding that instead of tapping the brakes, they'll remove the airbags. They're not prepared for what's right around the corner, said Jim Manley, who served as former Majority Leader Harry Reid's chief spokesman. As an institutionalist, I'm not surprised the president is sticking to these ill-advised norms. It doesn't make it less frustrating. He's failing to recognize the damage Republicans will do with this tool. For Democrats, it's increasingly an article of faith that Republicans will win back the House and, sometime in the first quarter of 2023, refuse to pass legislation to raise the debt limit without concessions from Biden. Again, something that literally just keeps the economy running as normal, and just literally a free. And this is why Biden is just to the Democratic Party to a certain extent is just not a serious party. They're just handing on a silver platter something for the Republicans to just really make them their lives absolutely miserable and saying, here, have it, no big deal. And also, it may just screw up the economy too, but no big deal. Republicans are openly talking about this scenario, and it's one Democrats lived through, obviously, in 2011. Back then, the country came perilously close to default, saved only by an 11th-hour deal, one Democrats agreed to hate, which was, I believe, actually the serious... I actually believe this was the deal where they cut entitlements. They literally did it already, and they're watching it happen again. The Democrats are literally watching it about to happen again. And with the same guy in charge, Biden made the deal with McConnell at the time. And it's just like, it's just very, very depressing. It was a shambolic process, such a shambolic process that Obama vowed to never negotiate around the debt limit again. He argued it was intellectually ridiculous to use the financial well-being of the American people as leverage, but it was also strategic since he left the Republicans with a choice, forced to default or move on, and a move on they eventually did. But Democrats took one precaution. Reid demanded Obama sideline Biden from the 2013 debt ceiling fight, and as another former Reid aide, Adam Gentleson, recalled, there was fear Biden would open the door again to negotiations. So, because Biden literally leads the deal on all of these situations and is just desperate, and has been desperate for his entire career to cut all of these programs. So, you know, should we trust that he's in a massive change of heart now? Maybe. I don't know. I certainly don't want to, but and this is not what we should rely our, you know, what's left of the welfare state on. But anyway, it is definitely for sure that this is a very dangerous situation. So flash forward 9 years and the fears are mounting again, and Biden's refusal to consider a bill eliminating the debt ceiling has put him at odds with his own Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, and the White House's insistence that it wants a clean bill without accompanying assistance to rule out negotiations entirely has put Biden at a more conciliatory place than his former boss Obama. Delivering hopes for Democrats, this is all pre-election posture, that once the midterm votes are cast, the White House's tone will harden, and at a minimum, they're pleading with the administration to take the issue off the table in the lame duck session where there's still Democratic control of government. I mean, come on. Just please do it while you still can. On Jason Furman on Monday, the former deputy director of the National Economic Council, suggested the party's reconciliation would pass the bill to raise the debt limit by $100 quintillion. So pretty much making it not an issue. Hiking that amount would eliminate the debt ceiling standoffs entirely without having to rely on Republican votes for the passage in the Senate. And while the attacks would come, they'd be long forgotten by the next election and would surely beat the prospect of a calamitous economic standoff likely to come without the action. So that is something to see. You know, will they just exercise basic common political sense? Will they get through to Biden? You know, only time will tell. You'll have to tune into the next News Flash next Tuesday to find out about that. But until then, have a great weekend, and we'll see you then. It's been News Flash.